From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. It's like there are two separate realities out there. One part of America sees in the tweets and spoken words and mannerisms of Donald Trump a man who may be emotionally unwell or may be going through cognitive decline. His supporters hear those fears as so much sour grapes or an illicit attempt to overturn an election. The issue has blown up wide open since Michael Wolff's book hit the bookstores last week. This hour on Point, the wild and worrisome debate about the president's mental competence. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the whole story? Do you see the mainstream media and liberal elites attacking your duly elected president? Or do you see a presidency going off the rails? Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Tolove. She's senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News and president of the White House Correspondents Association. Margaret, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you.
Well, there were a menu of tactical choices in response to the new book, Fire and Fury. Which did the White House choose?
The Fire and Fury choice. It's the White House's pushback has been pretty extraordinary over the course of the past few days since the publication of this book. The president, of course, asserting his mental stability and genius-like characteristics, and both the president and basically his entire team of surrogates going out there on television to bash Steve Bannon, try to discredit the White House chief strategist as much as possible and make clear that the bridge is burned. But this has completely engulfed the White House at a time when what they want to be talking about or thought that they wanted to be talking about is the tax bill passed last year, the infrastructure effort coming forward, the trying to stave off a government shutdown, trying to make a good case for the president's policies before midterms. And then now all of that is kind of shrouded in this black cloud of chaos, dysfunction, and defensiveness.
Is the reception to the Wolff book qualitatively and quantitatively different from that of the reception of the dangerous case of Donald Trump, where psychiatrists are speculating about the president's mental health?
Ray, what's different is that this book has punctured the seal in terms of entering the mainstream. It is in the bloodstream of every news report from morning until night. It is part of what people, regular people who don't think a lot about what psychiatrists think or what a small, corner of experts think. This is now a mainstream topic. The book has permeated all discussions at all levels. And it's because of that, I think, that it's so worrisome from the White House's perspective.
Not leaving anything to chance, the president was seen at Camp David with a coterie of top Republican office holders. Tell us about that tableau, what it looked like, and what you thought it was for.
I happened to have weekend duty for Bloomberg this weekend, so I got the pool call for 8 a.m. and had a feeling maybe that's where we were going. And we were taken up past the two checkpoints into a hangar where a blue velvet curtain and a podium and the flags were set up. And there came the full congressional Republican leadership and a couple of cabinet members to boot. And this was, of course, just hours after the very stable and genius tweets. And so I think certainly I and the other reporters were very curious to see kind of what would the president's state of mind seem like? Would he be as angry in person as he had seemed on Twitter? And instead, it's almost like that tweet had been cathartic. We saw a president who appeared completely at ease with what he'd been tweeting and what he'd said and done. And after weeks of not being available for that kind of traditional year-end news conference and this sort of stuff, held court for quite a while, encouraging questions on everything, the Mueller report, Iran, maybe we didn't do Iran, North Korea, the deliberations with Congress, and of course, this issue of the book and his tweets.
When you see Mitch McConnell, even an on-the-men Steve Scalise, Speaker Paul Ryan backing up the president, do we see a Republican Party coalescing around him in a way that when he was less under threat, we didn't see?
Well, we see a Republican Party that has decided that after casting their lot with him for this long, it could be catastrophic for them to turn on him, and that their best bet of holding control of both chambers, which is something that is now in doubt heading into this midterm season, is to stand by him and try to deflect the sort of drama questions and steer the topic back to the issues and the strategy. This was supposed to be a strategy session at Camp David, kind of a rah-rah session to decide, do we try to stick welfare reform on the agenda at the same time as infrastructure? Tactically, what's our best bet? How do we work with Democrats? And instead, instead, the default question is about this book. So this was all of the Republican leadership kind of swallowing their own concerns, all of which we're aware of. We've been hearing about for the last year, some publicly, some privately, some by other people discussing what these leaders are thinking. It's not like any of them think that these tweets are great or that any of this makes them comfortable, but they have all decided, look, this is the president. We're in the same party, and our best chance of getting our agenda is to show as much of a unified front as we can. And that's what you saw. But boy, to get inside the thought bubbles of everyone up at that podium by the curtain was what every reporter was hoping to do, and few of us were able to do.
Is one of the poster children for this tendency, Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina. Back in November, CNN juxtaposed two soundbites from Lindsey Graham, a recent one where the senator derides the media for portraying the president as unfit for office, and one from the days of the campaign where he used precisely the same words to say the president is indeed unfit for office. Here are the two bites back to back.
You know what concerns me about the American press is this endless attempt to label the guy as some kind of kook, not fit to be president.
I think he's a kook. I think he's crazy. I think he's unfit for office.
This can't have escaped your notice, Margaret Talev. What do you make of that?
Yeah, this is actually sort of a favorite sidebar topic of discussion among the press corps for a couple of reasons. And one is because Senator Graham's earlier comments, of course, were so dramatic and in such juxtaposition. It was almost like, is he trying to signal by directly kind of inside outing his comments from the past? Is he trying to indirectly signal to everyone, look, I'm doing this on purpose for a tactical reason, or is there something else going on? I haven't actually had a chance to sit down at any length and talk to Senator Graham. I want to be able to do that before I speculate on what he's doing. But I would put that in a different category than the way that leadership like Ryan and McConnell have handled this. It does seem that there's something different going on here. And because Senator McCain, who's ill now, has taken such a different tack, because Graham and McCain are almost always very closely aligned in terms of their approach, this has also sort of taken on some dissonance and some notice.
Margaret Talev is senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you so much.
At this point, I'd like to turn to Dr. Bandy Lee. She's a psychiatrist and a professor at the Yale School of Medicine's Law and Psychiatry Division. She organized, to some controversy, a conference of mental health professionals called the Duty to Warn Conference. And she edited a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. Last month, she briefed a dozen members of Congress on the president's mental state. Dr. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I should clarify, you've never spoken to Donald Trump, have you?
No, I have not.
Did any of the 27 people who wrote for the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, speak to the president?
Actually, there is one person who has encountered him, yes.
But
in the book itself, outside of the experts, because there are 27 experts and then three laypersons, one of the non-experts is Tony Schwartz, who, of course, spent an extensive period of time, I believe a year and a half, in his presence, listening to his conversations, accompanying him in order to write his biography.
But none of the people who are in a position to make a clinical observation on any human being.
So we're not speaking to Mr. Trump's personal health. His personal condition or diagnoses do not interest us. But what we are concerned about are the effects he is having on public health by virtue of the office that he's holding. So in other words, we are speaking to Mr. Trump in the office of the presidency being a risk to public health and safety.
Does the book make any conclusions that, in retrospect, you might want to make in a clinical setting solely?
So, first, let me clarify that I'm speaking on my own behalf,
okay,
not representing the views of my institutions, Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, or Yale Department of Psychiatry. And also, I'm not interested in making any comment on something I cannot assess from afar. And I have strictly instructed all authors of the book to refrain from making diagnoses or commenting on anything that could be any speculation, that is, from afar. So everything that we do is evidence-based. So there are specific instances that the authors cite. It is about things that we can observe from afar. In fact, when dangerousness is concerned, the personal interview yields very little information because they may not be willing to volunteer the kinds of things that would point to dangerousness. But we have seen a great deal of the president's responses to situations in real time, over time, extendedly, in ways that we often do not even have of our own patients. And other information that we observe include speeches, patterns of speeches over time, writings, reports from those who are intimate to the person.
Dr. Lee, let me stop you there, because that's exactly where I'd like to pick it up after a quick break. We're having a really serious discussion trying to figure out if reports that the president is mentally unfit for office, or whether, as his supporters say, those reports are nothing but slander, even medically unethical. You can join the conversation. Is this necessary for the country, or too speculative? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And we are here with a new show,
The Indicator from Planet Money.
On every show, we take some number in the news and we dive into it to find the big idea behind it.
Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about reports, assessments, speculations, call it what you will, about the mental fitness of Donald Trump for the job he holds. The administration is pushing back hard against the 1-2 punch of Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury and a report from more than 24 psychiatrists questioning the president's mental health. You can join the conversation. Who do you believe? White House officials who say the reports are not only wrong but irresponsible, or Michael Wolff's reporting from inside that same White House? My guest is Dr. Bandy Lee, a psychiatrist, a professor at the Yale School of Medicine, and editor of the bestseller The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Dr. Lee, so that you don't have to misrepresent anything or go beyond where the facts lie, let me use as the basis for some of my questions things that you yourself have said. In an interview with Vox, you said the special counsel's indictments started a crisis, a mental health crisis in a president who is not able to cope well with ordinary stresses such as basic criticism or unflattering news. Now, when a psychiatrist does the work of a psychiatrist, aren't those words that are used very carefully a mental health crisis? Can you observe that on television or in a Twitter feed?
Yes, and so we had been observing the patterns in the president, and the book itself was put together 8 months ago, and there was a long lag time for publication. But just when everyone was believing that the president was settling in his office and he was going to maybe pivot and become more normal, we were stating the opposite. And in fact, all those predictions bore out to be true. Of course, you can't predict exactly what one chooses to do. There is an element of free will. But there's a high probability that something may happen. And in fact, what we were saying was that Mr. Trump was actually worse than people were speculating, that he would grow worse under the pressures of the presidency and ultimately may become uncontainable. And what we were most afraid of was a crisis such as the special counsel's investigations and the indictments. And as the indictments closed in, we were seeing some of the signs of a crisis mode or what happens when someone is what we call decompensating. I've been using the word unraveling to make it a little easier. But what happens is that one's ability to keep oneself together is falling apart. And so the signs of it would include losing touch with reality, becoming more impulsive and volatile. And in Mr. Trump's case, based on his patterns, the tendency to go into attack mode and belligerence, as I've described before, would indicate a violent tendency. And the examples were these. We saw him returning to conspiracy theories that he had disespoused in the past. He had also denied that voice recordings of his on tapes were his, whereas he had admitted to them before, and he was retweeting some violent imagery.
Well, let me jump in there, because yes. Later in that same interview, you say, as you were just saying, when he returned and faced the progress of the special counsel's investigation, he became more paranoid, returning to conspiracy theories that he had let go of for a while. He seemed to further lose his grip on reality by denying his own voice on the Access Hollywood tapes. Now, you make a conclusion there that he is not lying. Are you in risk of pathologizing simple lying or tactical misstatement?
Yes. So one thing that mental health professionals can offer is a distinction between what are normal patterns and what are patterns of, say, strategizing, presenting a political front, if you will. It's very difficult to tell on a cross-sectional basis, and so one might even say impossible to tell. But over time, there are patterns that get revealed, and you see the person's responses over time. And in fact, signs of pathology are, in fact, they become rather predictable and rigid as they become more severe. And so you kind of have a running hypothesis in your head, and then you have it confirmed through proof. And as I said before, some of this information does not relate to what would be obtainable from a personal interview. It simply relates to patterns of behavior. And so what we are doing is we are not stating that Mr. Trump has a certain condition, or that any of these are definitive conclusions. We are stating that we see signs of danger, and we need to educate the public. And we often, in the rest of our profession, we have the obligation to report, to warn, and to take steps to protect potential victims when there are signs of danger.
So Dr. Bandy Lee is with me. She's from the Yale School of Medicine's Law and Psychiatry Division. She's the editor of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. In August, at a meeting on opioids in New Jersey, the president went off script to threaten North Korea. Here's President Trump.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power the likes of which this world has never seen before.
The simple practice of politics or something more sinister? Quincy, Massachusetts is our first stop. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I don't have a question, but more of just a couple of comments I'll share. I'm glad to see that there's a measured in-depth analysis on this issue, because I think it's important to be careful about protecting the office of the presidency when trying to determine if the person in that position has got mental health issues. And so the press, the public, you know, the media, medical professionals all need to be measured and careful in what they say. Unfortunately, I'm none of those, so I can just make a couple comments from my personal perspective, and here they go. I think you're basically talking about a person who's demonstrated a pretty profound lack of moral compass in terms of his criminal willingness and criminal intent, or not recognizing that his actions are criminal, are a component of this conversation about mental health. We have a guy who said, oh, my tax returns will become available when the IRS finishes an audit, which morphs into, oh, only the press wants to see these returns. You guys are fake media. Nobody else wants to see these returns.
But Jim, as distasteful as that is to you, the question is that just distasteful, or is it a sign of something more serious? That's the heart of the question.
Well, I believe that looking at this angle about whether or not somebody is willing to not recognize criminal intent or dismiss it in their own behavior as for any excuse is a feature of evaluating somebody's mental health. I leave the details and the finer points to the professionals, such as the person you have on the show today. But to me, we have a criminal for a president who's got mental illness. And again, I'm not bound by making comments as a professional in the medical community or being measured in my response as a media person. I think this guy is daffier than a box of taffy.
Jim, thanks a lot for your call from Quincy, Massachusetts. Very, very quick comment, Dr. Lee.
Yes. Oftentimes people can assume that the presence of mental impairment would mean that one would not be criminally responsible. I just wish to dispel that myth. The two are distinctly separate. It's very difficult to be determined not guilty by reason of insanity, even in the case of murder. But the two combined, mental impairment and criminal mindedness together, actually raise the risk of danger. And so in terms of dangerousness, the two occurring together, signs of both, are actually extremely concerning signs.
Dr. Bandy Lee is a psychiatrist and the editor of the bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Thanks for your time today, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to bring in another voice now, James Hamblin, also a medical doctor and now senior editor at The Atlantic. His recent story is called, Is Something Neurologically Wrong with Donald Trump? You can find a link on our website, onpointradio.org. James Hamblin, MD, joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is there, since you act as both a journalist and you're trained as a physician, are we wading into complicated and even treacherous waters when we try to do this kind of observation of a public figure?
Yes. And this is something I've been grappling with since, you know, the election, since before Trump was in office. And I was hearing concerns from doctors, psychiatrists and psychologists were signing petitions. This person is not fit to hold office, and telling me we are obligated to say something. And hearing from probably just as many mental health professionals saying, no, it undermines the practice. It is degrading to people with mental illness to conflate lying and potentially criminal behavior with mental illness. Not that there's never any connection, but that those are two distinct entities. And so it's very difficult. And no doctor, no expert I've spoken to feels 100% comfortable making conjectures, offering an analysis.
Well, you heard Bandy Lee, who just left us. The people who wrote for The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump build what might in a courtroom be called a circumstantial case for the unfitness of the president.
Right. Yeah, I think that they're doing the best with the circumstance, and they would ideally sit down and conduct as objective analytic of an interview and clinical assessment as possible, but that's just not on the table. So we have to deal with the information that we have available and how much can responsibly be said.
Remind us what the Goldwater Rule is.
The Goldwater Rule is a guiding principle in psychiatry that says you are not to render analysis, judgment, diagnosis of anyone who is not personally consented to be under your care. So there's a lot that goes into that, but it dates back to the late 1960s, and the rule was implemented in 1973, and it was because Barry Goldwater had been speculated about in a magazine called Fact Magazine, and some psychiatrists and psychologists had said various things about his mental state and speculated about his motivations, his deep states of insecurity, which may be informing his patterns of behavior. There was a lot of speculation that went on, and he had a lawsuit that led the American Psychiatric Association to say, okay, let's never go down that road again. Never say anything about anyone who's not directly under your care.
That's James Hamblin from The Atlantic. Oskaloosa, Iowa's next. Reggie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Reggie.
I think the Goldwater Rule is very appropriate since every Republican candidate or president since Goldwater has been called either insane or an idiot or a racist by the media. And this is no different. It's just a continuation of attacks on people they disagree with. And, you know, the people, I bet that you will not have anybody on that disagrees with the theory that Trump is insane today. And yet the people that believe it believe things like Bernie Sanders understands economics, Hillary is ethical, the media is non-biased. If those are the people that think someone's insane, that should be a badge of honor.
Well, I think we're dealing with different kind of labels here, aren't we, Reggie? I mean, you would want somebody who treats you and decides you've got some kind of problem to be basing that on more than an opinion, like some of the opinions that you named, that Bernie Sanders understands economics.
They are basing it on opinion. They're basing it on tweets and their predisposed opinion. He does things differently than any other president before because he's not a politician. He's a businessman. But they're basing it off of what politicians they believe should do.
Okay, well, let me give you an example then, Reggie. Let me give you an example. Dr. Lee, who you heard earlier, mentioned the case of the Access Hollywood tape, which Donald Trump earlier on, during the campaign, admitted was him, apologized for it, said it wasn't his best moment, and then a year later said wasn't him. Was he lying or delusional? Or just doing to things differently from other politicians?
Those are the same people that stood up for Harvey Weinstein. Those are the same people that stood up for Kevin Spacey for years, knowing what these men do, but then are using a double standard going after someone just because they don't agree with them. This has nothing to do with his mental health. The author of the book said he can't verify the facts in it. Many of the facts have come out to be lies. I believe he is just came out with it now as trying to make money. He never interviewed the president. He never interviewed the president's family. He got this information second and third hand. He has been known to write works of fiction. And, I mean,
well, you're talking about Fire and Fury from Michael Wolff. That's one case, and we will talk about that during the course of the hour. We're also talking about the dangerous case of Donald Trump, which is a lot less speculative and a lot more attempting, certainly, to be rigorous. Reggie joined us from Oskaloosa, Iowa. We've been getting some online correspondence. Nick mentions, thinking of it, he is a genius. He has done in a year more than any other president could have done in a term. I might not like it, but to accomplish as much against all odds requires genius and a hell of a lot of incompetence by the rest. Mark writes, SNL is going to have more of a field day with this very stable genius thing.
Nuclear Button writes, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated, oh, this is Trump himself, excuse me. Kathleen writes, most of us have been worried about this guy's mental health for a long time. The book only supports the observable mental inadequacies he's exhibited for 2 years. James Hamblin, hold on. We'll continue after the break. Listeners, when we come back, we'll talk to a GOP strategist who thinks the president is fine, and this whole discussion is, well, unnecessary. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.
Up first, it may be just the podcast you didn't know you were looking for. It's the morning news podcast from NPR. You can put it on during breakfast or while you're commuting, and you'll be caught up for the day in just about 10 minutes. That's it. Find Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the reports that President Trump may be unable, unsuited to serve his country because of mental health. You can join the conversation. Do we need, as my guest James Hamblin says, a routine way of checking our president's mental fitness for the most stressful, challenging office, well, maybe in the world? James Hamblin's piece in The Atlantic is called, Is Something Neurologically Wrong with Donald Trump? Joining us now from Washington is John Feary. He's a GOP political communications strategist and a partner at EFB Advocacy. He also blogs at thefearytheory.com. John, welcome to the show. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Ray, how you doing?
Okay, you and I began to talk about candidate Trump the day of the escalator ride in the lobby of Trump Tower, the day he declared his candidacy. Has your thinking about him as a politician, how he handles himself in public, how he does the public part of his work, changed over that time?
Well, listen, when Donald Trump first announced that he was president, I thought it was a lark. I didn't think he was going to be competitive. I thought that, you know, he had no chance. And I said that publicly. During the campaign, my views evolved because I think he did strike a chord with the American people who were sick and tired of politics as usual. They were sick and tired of Republicans saying one thing and doing something else. They were sick and tired of the whole political class, and they wanted some real action on the economy. And after a while, I became a supporter of Donald Trump. I can't support everything he says or does. I think that some of his tweets are kind of outside the norms of basic political communication. I would prefer that he would be better prepared before he talks to reporters, because I think sometimes when you just kind of wing it, you can get yourself in inconsistent trouble. And I've seen that with my own experience working with politicians. Sometimes you don't know all the facts, and if you spout off things and you kind of make a fool out of yourself, that happens. But you know, Donald Trump is a completely unconventional politician, and he has shaken up Washington to its core, which is, I think, what the American people actually want. They wanted someone to come in and shake up the Washington establishment. And, you know, if you talk to anyone, right, you know this better than I do, people in Washington are taking notice that this guy is something completely different.
What do you make of speculation and the dovetailing of this case of Donald Trump from the psychiatrists, the new book, and Michael Wolff's book, the dovetailing in the public mind that this is not just an unconventional politician, but someone who may have mental, emotional problems?
Well, you know, as someone who's worked in Republican politics for a long time, you kind of get used to this kind of stuff. I mean, the Democrats and the left tend to call people who don't agree with them crazy and or racist, as I like what Reggie had to say. You know, the Goldwater rule was put in because, you know, Barry Goldwater won the case. Otherwise, there would be no Goldwater rule. There has been a history where Republican candidates are called stupid. I mean, think of Ronald Reagan. He was called dumb. And I remember very, very vividly when Jimmy Carter and others and John Anderson and others said that, you know, if Ronald Reagan became president, we would have a nuclear war. So, you know, the idea that the left attacks Republicans, delegitimizes them as being either crazy or incompetent or racist, has a long history. And, you know, if you're a Republican, you kind of get used to it. And so I think it's all typical. I mean, you know, the Michael Wolff thing, you know, he has written so many things about other public figures like Rupert Murdoch that turned out to be completely counterfactual. You know, there's no doubt that he had some sources that were willing to to spout off. But I don't believe a lot of what's in that book. I believe some of what is in the book, but it's hard to separate fact from fiction. My biggest question is about Michael Wolff's access is how did he get that access? And that shows to me some complete incompetence on the Trump administration, the folks who probably are no longer working for this administration, but who let this guy in. I mean, it was really a wolf in sheep's clothing is what I call him.
John Feary is with us, also James Hamblin from The Atlantic. And now Tampa, Florida. Dallas is calling. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Listen, I think you can make a better case for Donald Trump being a genius than you can for him being incompetent. By definition, the definition of genius is a person who is exceptionally intelligent or creative, either generally or in some particular respect. And if you go against 16 other Republican candidates who are longtime career politicians, and you go against the political machine of Hillary Clinton, and the preponderance of reporting from the media that said that he was not capable of becoming president, and then you become the president of the United States, never having run for office before. I mean, that would be an exceptionally creative person, or at least generally exceptionally intelligent in some way to do that. So the case should be made that I think this whole show is really kind of ludicrous, and the woman, Dr. Leaf, is very irresponsible for writing a book like this, and the case could probably be made that she's pretty incompetent for doing something like that, in my opinion.
Dallas, thanks for your call. James Hamblin, Donald Trump is about to have a physical exam. Do we have a required physical exam for presidents?
This is a norm that the president will go to Walter Reed and have a physical exam and traditionally share the results. What you learn are things like any chronic conditions, high blood pressure, whether they smoke, what medications they might be taking. But we don't have an assessment for early cognitive decline, which people over 65 are at high likelihood of experiencing, and that can progress to Alzheimer's disease. And there's no process for evaluating it. Presidents. This was proposed by Jimmy Carter in 1994 when Ronald Reagan came out with his Alzheimer's diagnosis just 5 years after leaving the presidency, and quickly faded into being unable to recognize people or even aware that he was president. That was reported as soon as 1997. And so then there was a big push in the 90s to say, well, we should have some way of assessing whether someone is experiencing early cognitive decline or imbalances in judgment, inability to comprehend information, to make basic decisions, and the public should be aware of that. And that is an idea that's coming back to life right now.
John Feary, would you think that's a good idea, that whatever president, whatever party, from now on, we might be better off if we knew about the physical and mental health of the president of the United States, whoever it is?
Well, I think that we do have, I think it's smart to have a physical. We've had presidents in the past, Woodrow Wilson, Dwight Eisenhower, who had physical problems, and especially Woodrow Wilson, who couldn't serve out, who basically had his second wife serve out his role as president. Obviously, Ronald Reagan had a sharp decline in cognitive power in the last couple years, although he did leave the president as a overwhelmingly popular president, one of our most popular presidents in history. So, there is that case. I think, it's probably a good idea to have a diagnosis as part of the regular treatment. I don't necessarily think you need to have a psychiatric diagnosis, because I think that that's so fraught. I think the field of psychiatry is, not necessarily as scientific as some people would say. And I think that, but having a physical is obviously a part of the norm, and should continue to be as part of a norm. And if there's, some measurement you can take of the ability to, fight Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or debilitating diseases like that, which is something that, we need to take very seriously in this country, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Bruce is calling now from Providence, Rhode Island. Bruce, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I absolutely agree with and respect Dr. Lee's opinions and the work that she's been doing. I work as a lawyer with psychiatrically disabled people, and I think she's doing a very good job of kind of walking a thin line between legal notions of incapacity and medical ones. But my feeling is, if the concerns about Trump's pathological inability to function as chief executive are going to be acted upon, either 25th Amendment or impeachment, groundwork has got to be laid with his voters, and particularly 30% of his true believers. And it's easy for me as a liberal to say, hey, I told you so a year ago. But I think that we can soften the blow to his base and kind of dislodge the heels that they have dug into the mud by focusing on the damage the office seems to be doing to him. I mean, we are seeing a real decline neurologically, cognitively, psychiatrically, that can reasonably be attributed to the stress of the office.
Well, Bruce, right now that's a political process, isn't it? Not a medical one, to decide when and whether to remove someone from office?
Absolutely. But that is the reason that I think anybody, be it the cabinet acting under the 25th Amendment or Congress dealing with impeachment, has to feel like they're not uncorking horrible civil unrest by taking that action. And I guess what I want to say is that that base should be made to feel like they might have made a reasonable decision voting for Trump a year ago, saying this guy's not a politician, he's a businessman, whatever, even if I don't agree with that. But the job itself is doing damage to him. And so maybe they can look at, they can kind of experience buyer's remorse not as having gotten a defective product, but one that's just worn out prematurely.
Bruce, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Tampa, Florida. Adrian's on the line. Adrian, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm going to try to be quick. The first thing I always think when we have conversations like this is that if Barack Obama had behaved like this, that people would not be saying, oh, he's just different and he's a businessman. And I also think that I do believe that Donald Trump is incompetent, and I don't really know that I feel like the reasons why matter. I think what matters is that he's not doing his job. He is very incompetent in the way he communicates as the leader of the country, and I think that's what needs to be addressed. And when people often, you know, the response is always that, oh, he's just different and that he's a businessman, and I think it's important to have high-level businessmen on these shows and ask them if they think the way he behaves and the way he speaks to people and the way he addresses other world leaders is actually professional and businesslike. I think the level of his competence is the issue. I don't know if the reason for those things is the issue.
Adrian, thanks a lot for your call. James Hamblin, right now there's all this speculation. Where should it best go? What would be a good outcome given where things stand at the moment, given the reporting that you did for your Atlantic article?
So I think we need to have as much objective information to inform the public as possible. And when there are so many concerns of experts, it's worth introducing the idea of cognitive assessment exams that are the sort used to test whether someone is has the capacity to, for anything from attend graduate school to operate the nuclear missile launch facilities to any number of things in which we have objective assessments of people's cognitive faculties, and then making that information available to the American public, and so that people can know where we stand on the president's cognitive fitness, and it can put all of this to rest. And if the scores are low and people want to ignore that or say that it's fake, that's the will of the voters. And if they're good, then a lot of people can rest easier at night.
Can we, in a non-hysterical way and without being ageist, talk about the fact that we just elected the oldest president in American history?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were both right about the same age. And if you were to have someone like Joe Biden run, he would be 78 at the time of inauguration in 2021. This is something that, as the population ages, is a new challenge for our country, and we need a system in place to be able to deal with it.
John Fieri, right now, the way the 25th Amendment to the Constitution is written, as I suggested to our earlier caller, Bruce, it is largely a political rather than medical process. In real time, are the passions of the day just too high for us to enter this conversation about Donald Trump?
Well, this is a partisan discussion. If you did not like Donald Trump during the election, you don't like him now, and you want him removed from office. This has been very consistent from the left. This is what they want. They don't want Donald Trump to be their president. They're horrified by him. If you voted for Donald Trump or you like Donald Trump, you still want him to be in office because you like the economy growing. You like the fact that there's the lowest unemployment rate for African-Americans since 1970s. You like the fact that there's the prospects for economic growth and you're going to get more money for taxes. You like the fact that he's standing up for the Iranian protesters, and you like this guy. And so this is a partisan discussion. The psychiatrists are partisan. They probably thought that Donald Trump was crazy during the campaign, and they probably didn't vote for him. So I think this is all nonsense. I really do. I think that you can have these psychiatrists from Yale who, and if you're from Yale, the chances are there's very little chance that you're from Yale if you voted for Donald Trump. I think that, you know, they don't like Donald Trump, but they want get rid of Donald Trump, and I don't think it's going to happen. So I think it's just kind of, you know, partisanship at its worst.
From our online audience, Roger writes, Trump is well past the age that health concerns, both physical and mental, can become an issue. Les writes, the utility of being unpredictable is a theme of this administration's foreign policy. Could this be their preferred strategy domestically as well? And Alexandra adds, this debate is ludicrous. We know what we see and hear, an impulsive, out-of-control, chaotic president of the United States. And the GOP says it sees nothing. I want to thank both my guests. James Hamblin is senior editor at The Atlantic. He spoke to us from New York. James, thanks for your time. And John Fieri is a GOP political communication strategist and a partner at EFB Advocacy. He joined me from Washington. John, I appreciate your coming on.
Hey, thanks, Ray. Appreciate it.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Ray Suarez News. Coming up tomorrow, the Trump administration rules nearly 200,000 Salvadorans must leave the country or be deported. Now what? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.